You may be seated. I want to invite you to turn in your Bible to Acts chapter 27. We are in the second to last chapter of the book of Acts, and this chapter is really the epilogue. We've encountered the highlight of Acts. We've seen its climax, and that climax last week was Paul's defense before King Agrippa, where he made his bold proclamation of the gospel and actually tried to bring Agrippa to faith. He begged Agrippa to believe the prophets and to believe that Jesus the Christ had risen from the dead. Agrippa found no problems with Paul. He thought Paul was crazy, or at least someone who just was going beyond his boundaries. But Paul had appealed to Caesar. Paul wanted to get to Rome. Paul had been promised by Jesus that he would get to Rome. And so he takes off in our story as a prisoner, no longer a free man. He is not in control of his life. And in fact, for the last six or seven chapters, he hasn't been in control of his life. He's been a prisoner bound in chains. And here we find him not just a prisoner, but he's human cargo. He's just a prisoner that's being transferred from one prison in Caesarea to another prison in Rome. And because of that, he really has very little value anymore to anyone that is in his that's keeping him in custody. But he has the favor of a wonderful commander we're going to meet tonight, Commander Julius. We have a fantastic story before us in Acts chapter 27. It is an adventure at sea. It's such a change of pace from all that's preceded us in the book of Acts, because it's an action tale. This story is so full of action. It's almost one of those chapters that you wish that we could just put on film, because it would make an incredible action sequence in a film. And people wonder, why is it that we've gone through all these speech after speech, kind of this slow-running drama with a lot of dialogue and interaction, and then we move to this hectic pace of action? Some people have suggested that Luke's doing this because he wants to please his audience. He wants to make sure that the Greco-Roman audience that reads this is satisfied with a tale of adventure that they'd be used to, a tale of seafaring people and the perils they face at sea. But I don't think that's why Luke is doing it. I think he's happy to include what is the equivalent of a car chase in the book of Acts. He's happy to make this drama have a little bit of action. But the action is there for a reason, and the reason is what we'll reflect upon when we get to the end of our message tonight. I believe that there's a deep spiritual lesson in this storm, that Luke is trying to say something to the church that he knows is reading this. Remember the opening chapter of Acts. Theophilus, I'm writing this to you. Luke is writing to the church, and he wants to encourage the church to remain faithful and strong in the midst of their own life situations. And so he's including this storm and all that surrounds it for the purpose of giving spiritual insight to the church then and to the church now. And so we're going to go through this. I hope you'll just kind of follow along. Keep your finger on the text, because we're going to keep popping back and forth. It's so full of action. And I want to give you a sense of where we're going on some of these maps, so you can see where the ship actually ends up at the end. So we're chapter 27, verse 1. When it was decided that we, and there's the we, so Paul has a companion, perhaps it's Luke, our author, or perhaps it's someone else, but it's we would set sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, remember this man, who belonged to the imperial regiment. We boarded a ship from Adramyttium, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia. And we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. Boy, there's going to be a lot of big words today. We're safe at port. We are at Caesarea. This is where all of the trial before Festus and then before King Agrippa took place. And we're really just going to jump right to Sidon. And you'll see it in verse 3. The next day we landed at Sidon. All of that introduction is to show that when you wanted to get to Rome, and Rome is way over about here. I mean, it's up there. If you want to make it to Rome, it's not like there were official ships that the soldiers had to get on. They would have to find ships that had cargo that were trying trying to get cargo from one place to another, or ships that were passing in the direction that they were going, and they'd pay a fee and they'd hop on the ship. And so Julius finds a ship that's at least heading in that direction, but before they even begin to move west, they take this stop off at Sidon. And it's fortunate that they do, because we're going to find something wonderful about Julius, this centurion, not just at the beginning of our story, but at the end. Verse 3, "The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul." Now that's a strange combination, to have a Roman centurion with a prisoner to show philanthropos, brotherly love. Kindness, that's the word, brotherly love. So he shows this kindness to Paul, and here's what he does. He allowed him to go to his friends so that they might provide for his needs. People question, why is it that Julius shows kindness to Paul? Why does he treat him so humanely? And there's a number of reasons we could toss out. Perhaps he sees that Paul's not really a threat. Perhaps he knows that there's no real charge that can stick for this guy, and so Paul's not a threat to anyone, and perhaps that's the reason he shows kindness. Paul doesn't need intense surveillance. He's not really a threat to Rome. Perhaps it's Julius' awareness that Paul's a Roman citizen, just like he, and so he shows him kindnesses that you'd show to a fellow Roman citizen. But we should never rule out the force and grace of Paul's persona. It may just be that Paul was the kind of guy that knew how to make friends with those that he was around. So whatever the combination of those is, Julius, for some reason, is showing great kindness, and he allows Paul to go to his friends, as we read in verse 3. That way Paul has provisions, because Rome didn't provide provisions. You would starve if you didn't have friends that would help you. And so Paul is allowed to go. He has provisions for this long voyage, and he is in this very fortunate spot where Julius seems to favor him. So the trek continues on. Verse 4, "From there we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us." And that's my favorite phrase in this whole story, because that foreshadows trouble. The winds were against us. The winds that were against them shows that there's a situation here that might call for Paul trying to perhaps delay this trip. He sees trouble on the horizon. Now, before we get any further with that warning that Paul's going to give, we have a little sailing to do. "When we had sailed," verse 5, "across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we arrived at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days." That means they're not keeping on schedule. The winds are against them. "And they had difficulty arriving off Cnidus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lycia." Now, here's what's interesting. You can kind of see how this trek is panning out. You can see the course they take. The winds will not allow them to get to this city. And so the winds push them, and they decide that they're going to make a stop off Crete. They end up landing in Fair Havens. If only they had stayed here, we wouldn't have this tremendous action story. Because Paul is going to make a strong appeal that the winds are against them, they're behind schedule, the time's getting late, we're about in the stormy season past October, and so for their own good, they need to just stay in Fair Havens. But Julius is going to feel like they ought to at least get to the port that's in Phoenix. That's what's going to happen in our next paragraph. And you can see how Paul makes his argument. Verse 9. "Much time had been lost." So again, they're way behind schedule. The stormy seasons are coming. "And sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the fast." The fast is the Day of Atonement. So we're in September or October, depending on the lunar calendar. Travel by sea is going to become increasingly more risky. Storms can blow a ship off course. You don't have engines. You just have sails. You're at the mercy of the winds in whichever way they blow. You also, in the stormy season, have clouds and fog, which makes it impossible to navigate because you navigate by the stars. So it's a dangerous thing, and Paul sees that there's some danger. So Paul warned them, verse 10, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. Paul takes the role of Eeyore. This is a disaster. This is going to just be a wreck. We can't do this. It's all going to be a disaster. We can't do this. And so Paul, you know, declares this message, which obviously wasn't very popular. And what's interesting is he's allowed to say this, which shows the favor he has with Julius. He at least is given the ability to voice his dissent and his concern. Verse 11, but the centurion, this would be Julius, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. You can't blame Julius for following the advice of the pilot, in contrast to this gospel preacher who seems to have a bad attitude. You just can't blame him. Paul's not a seafaring shipman. He is this traveling preacher. And so it's not, you know, to his detriment that the centurion decides he's going to listen to the expert. He is, however, going to agree with Paul. They're not going to make it all the way to Rome and Italy, so that he's going to hope that they can make it to Phoenix. And you see that play out here. Verse 11. Since the harbor at Fair Havens was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbor in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. So they hope, knowing that they are way behind schedule, they hope that they can just make it a little bit further to a better port so that they can winter there, knowing that there's easier access to the further destination that they are headed towards. So they just want to make this little hop, skip, and jump. And the winds seem to be going in their direction. The winds seem to approve the majority decision, as we read here in verse 13. When a gentle south wind began to blow, and isn't a gentle south wind, they thought they had obtained what they wanted. So they prematurely think, hey, this is great. You know, we made the right decision. This is perfect. So they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force, these huge gales called the Northeaster, swept down from the island. So everything looks good for just a moment. They're emboldened by that gentle south wind. It looks like they're going to get to their destination. And all of a sudden, they are at the mercy of hurricane force winds. They are in the center of a storm. And being in this storm, they are at its mercy and they are in great peril. So that all of a sudden, verse 15, the ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind. So we gave to it and were driven along by it, driven to where they didn't want to go. Verse 16, as we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. So they make it to... Let me see if I can get to... I got so many slides on this. There's the ship. They make it to an island that's so small, you don't even see it. It's just a speck. And they're able there to be behind some winds and to make preparations, knowing they're in the middle of a great storm. They're going to have to really make sure that their ship is seaworthy. And most importantly, they want to make the lifeboat secure. You know why? Because if the ship goes under, they at least got a lifeboat. So that lifeboat's going to become very important as our story goes on. Verse 17, so when the men had hoisted it aboard, obviously the lifeboat was either behind them and it was causing some drag or it was causing problems and they needed to bring it on ship. They get it on ship. They passed ropes under the ship in order to hold it together. And it's at this point you see how desperate the situation's becoming. Things are starting to crack. Leaks are starting to sprout. And all of a sudden they're passing cords or cables under the ship just to keep its bottom together. Then further desperation, fearing that they would run aground on the sandbar of Syrtis, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. So you're at the mercy of the winds, you lower the anchor so that as you're being dragged where you don't want to be dragged, at least you're dragged more slowly. So they're trying to do everything they can to fight this storm. Desperation becomes more great in verse 19. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Actually, I missed verse 18. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. So, poor pilot, because he owns the ship, you know where his money comes from. and he's watching his money go into the sea. There's going to be no money made on this. The cargo just goes overboard. And then verse 19, on the third day, they now throw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Here's how desperate it becomes, verse 20. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. Now at that point you realize what is happening. The sun and the stars are completely hidden by the clouds. It's a storm that just won't stop. They don't even know where they are. They can't navigate anymore. There's no sun, there's no moon, there's no stars, there's no instruments of navigation. The storm is continuing in severity, and you reach the lowest point where at the end of verse 20, we finally give up all hope of being saved, but you really need to notice the word, we. So that Paul's companions, Paul's faith-filled Christian companions, whether it's Luke and Aristarchus or who knows whoever else, the people that are accompanying Paul, who stand for the mission of Christ, have said, we're doomed. We are going to die. They lose all hope of being saved. That's how severe the crisis is. And when you realize how severe the crisis is, it is going to absolutely amaze you that Paul will retain hope. That Paul refuses to give in to this despair. And if he's the only one that will believe, then so be it. He's going to stand strong and he's going to try to encourage these men to not give in. So verse 21, after the men had got a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, and I love this, men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. Paul obviously has the fruit of the Spirit. None of them are tact. There's no tact with Paul. He just flat out says, I told you so. I mean, I warned you about this. That's not the best way to win friends and influence people. But it does prove that he was right. One of my favorite I told you so is there's a tombstone and the epitaph on this tombstone is, I told you I was sick. I've always loved that. I'd love to put that on mine. I told you I was sick. Now you believe me? Paul does it here. I told you that we were doomed. I told you there was nothing but trouble in this direction, but none of you would listen to me. But he's not just an I told you so guy alone. Verse 22. But now, I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost, only the ship will be destroyed. How could Paul say that? Not one of you will be lost. Everyone listening to me is going to be survived. Oh yeah, the ship will be destroyed. We're all going to survive. This ship is going down. Here's why Paul says that, and listen to how he says it to a predominantly group of Greco-Roman sailors who know nothing of the gospel of Christ, who know nothing of the tradition of the Jews. They have a pantheon of gods. They all worship different gods or many gods. You throw them in a basket, they'll take any of the gods. They have a whole pantheon. So Paul is going to tell them why he has this confidence, and he needs to speak of Jesus, but he's going to speak it in a way that they can understand. Verse 23, last night, an angel just means a messenger of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me. That is a great way in a group of unchurched, unbelieving, Greco-Roman idolaters to say, I'm not trying to convert you. Now's not the time for conversion. We just need to save our skin. I'm not trying to, say, hey, we're all gonna perish here. Now's the time to believe in Jesus, guys. Can I tell you about Jesus? I will never forget, at my very first church, we were often given the 15-second gospel. If you had 15 seconds to give someone the gospel, what would you do? What would you say? And you know what I always said, and this is why I continually got into more and more trouble at my first church. I said, I wouldn't say anything. You can't say the gospel in 15 seconds. You just can't. You think that the story of Israel and Jesus and the fulfillment of the prophecies and what resurrection for the dead means and hope and faith, you can distill that down to some 10-second, little phrase or statement. So I'd always say, I wouldn't tell them anything. I would just, you know, pray for us as we're dying, you know, because the idea was you have 10, 15 seconds, then they're going to die. So I would get into trouble for that. And I think Paul here bears my perspective out, because they're in deep doo-doo. And instead of Paul taking advantage of their desperation and saying, let me tell you the gospel while I got you cornered here, he instead says, look at the phrase again, verse 23. Last night, an angel of the God, whose I am this God's servant, and whom I serve. So this is the God that calls me his own, and I call this God my own. That angel stood beside me, and here's what the angel said to me. Do not be afraid, verse 24, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. I would guess that this is Paul's roundabout way of saying Jesus told him that he had a vision of the risen Christ, because it's happened to him before. And the Christ told him, you will get to Rome, and everyone with you will get to Rome. And that's why Paul, in the midst of the storm and the seas and there being no skies or stars or any navigation, this battering storm sending this ship going who knows where, can say, hey guys, not one of you will die. I've been told by the God whose I am and whom I serve that I will get to Rome. And guess what out this God has said, who's incredibly gracious to a world that ignores this God, everyone else will be graciously saved too. Everyone else will be graciously saved with you. And so Paul says, that's the message I have. So verse 25, so keep up your courage, men. Why? For I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island. Paul in verse 25 does something magnificent. He says, I want you to keep courage, men, not because you have faith, but because I have faith. I want you to stand, if you can't on your own, then stand on my faith. Because I am convinced that what I've been told will come to pass. Now, in many ways, that echoes what we should say with every promise that God gives us, that this will come to pass, that this is true, that this word is sure, that this will happen in such a way that I can have the confidence to stand on this promise. And if you don't believe it, well, I will. And if nothing else, stand with me. Take courage. Stand with me as I stand in faith. You don't need to have it, but I'm going to have it. But, verse 26, we are going to run into ground. We are going to shipwreck. So get ready, it's going to happen. So Paul does this, he gives them some courage, and perhaps for a moment they have courage. We don't get any sense of their response. My guess is you probably had a lot of stone-cold responses. My guess is you probably had a lot of people that just hung their head and thought, who is this crazy weirdo? Who is this convict, this rebel against Rome, for all we know, who really's just got crazy things to say? And why does Julius keep letting him to talk? Why doesn't Julius shut him up? But you've probably noticed by now, Paul's effectively in charge. Paul's moved from being a prisoner to effectively being in charge, and that becomes more apparent as the story carries on. See how desperate it gets by verse 27? On the 14th night, so 2 weeks, darkness, storm, battering, waves. On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea. When about midnight, so this is deep in the night, the sailors sensed they were approaching land. Perhaps they heard the breakers. And so verse 28, they took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found that it was 90 feet deep. So they're getting closer to land. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. So they toss out the anchors. They do this, and there's actually archaeological evidence of this that you can find in this very region as you're getting closer and your ship's out of control with the wind, that you'll see anchors that have been left, and then another few feet, another anchor, and then a shipwreck. Because there's an attempt to slow down the ship that is outside of one's control and at least use the anchors to make it so when you finally hit land, you're not hitting it at full speed. And so they start throwing out the anchors. They're just praying, oh, can daylight come so we can at least see when we hit land. In an attempt, verse 30, and here's where it gets really desperate. Remember that lifeboat? Verse 30, in an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. That's pretty ruthless, isn't it? But they're fearing for their life. They have no reason to believe Paul. And so they pretend like they're going to, you know, throw out some more anchors. They grab the lifeboat. They're going to escape. They're at least going to try to survive and make it out alive. They could care less what happens to all of the criminals on the ship. But Paul finds out about this, verse 31. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved. So Paul's in charge. You know, these guys, they can do this, but if they do this, I may be the only one alive. So the only way that we're all going to survive is if you stop this. So, verse 32, the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. And again, if I were making a movie, you'd just have these angry sailors, these confused sailors. I mean, there goes the lifeboat. Their last opportunity, their last best hope in the midst of the situation they're in is just floating away, all because this convict has said, we're all going to survive. We're all going to survive if we stick together. It's only the ship that's going to be destroyed, but we will survive. Well, finally dawn arrives. Verse 33. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. That's a sign that they don't really think they're going to survive. You stop eating when you think that death is approaching. I mean, no reason to have a nice, succulent, wonderful meal. You just kind of abandon all hope and you're just surviving. But now he says, I want you to eat. Verse 34, I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. After he said this, he took some bread and he gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and he began to eat. Now, observant parishioners should realize that's exactly the formula of Eucharist. He took, he gave thanks, he broke, and then they eat. So he is doing something here, and Luke's writing it in such a way that whoever's reading this will say, huh, that sounds an awful lot like Lord's Supper. That sounds an awful lot like communion. I really don't think it is, but I think Luke has a deeper point to be made because Paul's not going to share a communion meal with all these people who have no idea of what it's about without in some way talking about it. But he's doing what a good, normal, faithful Jew would do. You would pray. You'd give thanks. You know, we're going to eat. You give thanks. You break the bread. And we're all going to share in this. And here's what happens. Verse 36, they were all encouraged. They had hope again. And they ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. So this is the Last Supper, potentially. They throw all the grain, they have the last meal. Even though it's probably not Eucharist that Paul's celebrating here, it certainly is the bread of hope. And that starts inching toward what we think about when we think about the Lord's Supper or communion or the Eucharist. So the people are beginning to take hope again. It looks like they may actually survive this. Verse 39, when daylight came, they did not recognize the land, so they don't know where they're actually at, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. So they're hoping that they can hit this certain reef, that they can arrive and crash, but crash in such a way that they all survive. So they're going to hope to run this aground. Verse 40, cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. So they're trying to use the wind. They're letting go of the anchors. They're going to do everything possible to hit a certain spot on this stretch of land that they found. Well, for all their efforts, it kind of goes bad. Verse 41, but the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the wave. So the ship hits ground and it begins to disintegrate. It's falling to pieces, but they're at least close to land. Now you've got one additional problem. This ship is full of convicts. It's full of prisoners. Paul himself is a prisoner. You have only so many guards. And then, of course, you have the sailors who are trying to make money off the cargo. With this being their vocation, you have the owner and other such things. But the soldiers had a plan, verse 42. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. Because we already know that should any of the prisoners end up missing, the soldiers will pay with their life. It is their responsibility to get the prisoners to Rome. And so their own well-being is at risk. And so they think, you know, what's it going to hurt? We're already in a shipwreck. No one's going to notice. These are just a bunch of convicts. No one's going to care if they all end up dying. And that's the story we'll tell. That we had a shipwreck and they all died. It's not that they escaped. They all died. So that's the plan. And that plan would have come true if it weren't for Julius. Julius from the beginning has favored Paul. Julius perhaps has been watching all of this take place, and now that they're almost at land, it seems like Julius plays his strongest hand by saying, I'm going to stand with Paul. He may not know why he does. He doesn't in any way, I think he's intentionally fulfilling the will of God or doing what God would want. But he is doing something because he likes Paul. He favors Paul. So verse 43, but the centurion, that's Julius, wanted to spare Paul's life. And Paul's a prisoner. And kept the soldiers from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. So the soldiers are forbidden from doing this. Anyone that can swim, get in the water, make it to land. Verse 40, whatever the last verse is, 44. The rest were to get there on planks or on pieces of the ship, so that swimming or floating on debris, group by weary group, they all collapse alive on Malta. And this way, everyone reached land in safety. I don't think Paul at that point said, see, I told you so. You guys listened to me. I don't think he had to. There was no need to. But what he had said had come true. And just to get a sense of where that storm had taken them, they were hoping to get to Phoenix. Now they're all the way at Malta. This is where they end up shipwrecked on this small island. And about 3 weeks from now, when I'm back from vacation, we'll look at them shipwrecked and lost on the island of Malta because some incredibly interesting things happen regarding Paul and the people of Malta in chapter 28 as we come to the close of the book of Acts. Now that's the chapter. You see how it's full of action. I mean, it's full of all these seafaring terms and the kind of terms that an ancient audience would just relish. They would love all the excitement and the hoisting of the sails and the throwing of the anchors and all the drama that's taking place. They would love to hear a story of someone battling the elements and rising above them and being able to survive in the midst that has a heroic element for any Greco-Roman who might be hearing this. But I don't think Luke is telling this story to satisfy an ancient's desire for some drama, for some action in what is predominantly a theological narrative. I think there are other things going on, and I want to close with these three reflections that speak about why I think this chapter is here and why it's so important and why I'm glad we didn't skip it. We call this message Riding the Storm Out, and that, of course, is what Paul has just done as well as all the others with him. But one of the questions you might ask is why a storm and why such detail? Paul has traveled before. We've read about him traveling all over the place in the book of Acts. I mean, he's been all over the land. He's taken numerous ships already, but we never get this kind of detail. So why all the detail at this point? And I think the answer is quite simple. For the people of Israel, the sea represented chaos and death. The sea is a place where there's no stability. There's no place to stand. it is as dangerous as can be. Not only is there no stability or no place to stand, but lurking its waters are mysteries that perhaps they didn't know of. There were sea monsters that they imagined and some that perhaps were real. There were things in the sea that made them realize that the sea is not a place to be. You want to be on terra firma if in any way possible, because the sea is a dangerous place. It's full of chaos. It's full of storms. And that's why from the very beginning, in the story of the Exodus, when God delivers God's people from Egyptian oppression, one of the first stories that highlights redemption and salvation is that they are delivered through the Red Sea by Moses. That the sea parts, and through Moses and the power of God and their commitment to God, their faith in God, but even more so, God's faith in them, God's love for them. They pass through this storm unhurt. The idea of being delivered from sea is a constant theme in scriptures. And because of that, I think that Luke has included this because he knows the church is reading this. And the ancient church that is reading this is predominantly a persecuted church. They are people that are paying a price for being Christians. They are losing jobs. They are being torn and thrown out of guilds. They are, some of them, experiencing real physical persecution. To become a Christian in this time meant that your life was on the line. That you would face storms inevitably, not just the normal storms we experience in just the day-to-day routines of life, but the storms and fires of persecution. And I think that's why this storm is here, because even though Paul is straight in the midst of God's will, going exactly where God is directing him in Christ, straight to Rome to take the gospel to the uttermost parts of the earth, it doesn't mean that he doesn't experience deep and devastating and destructive storms that challenge his faith to the very core, that challenge his faith to the point where he's the last man standing, saying, I'm going to believe. I've been told I'm going to Rome, and I believe that God will get me there. In light of that, I love this quote by David Garland. He says the reason we have this storm is this: trust in God, who is strong to save, applies not just to seafaring, but to all of life. When the inevitable storms hit, one might experience paralyzing fear, nauseating sickness in the soul, and deep despair. It is then that one should be reminded that God saves us not from storms, but through storms. We always live in thankfulness to God before, in, and after the storm. And the way Paul expresses that thankfulness is the way Luke wants the church to express their faith in the midst of their storm. Because Luke has conveniently put the Eucharist in the center of the deepest, most destructive, most damaging storm possible. And there in the midst of that storm, you find Paul, and he may not be celebrating per se the Lord's Supper with the people that are around him, but I guarantee Theophilus and the church that was with him that's reading this would immediately think, he's celebrating communion. That's where his hope is coming in the midst of this storm. In the midst of this storm, Paul refuses to give in and to go under. Instead, he's going to stand strong and take and give thanks and break and eat, just like we must do, persecuted church, caught with the winds against us in this storm. That we don't abandon the table. Instead, we find that that's the place of stability. That's the place where we go to and say, this is the food for the storm. This is the place that gives hope in the midst of the darkness of the storm. Jennings writes this: such a simple act, the act of Eucharist, has no power in and of itself, but it becomes the source of hope and the sign of divine love in our story and then for Luke's readers. Even in our time, no one's feet are on solid ground. We are always on this ship. And the question for the church is not whether we will eat, but when and where we will offer food and under what conditions will we invite those fear-laden and troubled to eat. The question is not if we will eat the food of the Eucharist in the midst of the storm. It is, how willing will we be to share that to everyone possible? Because Paul, in the midst of this storm, carries out the acts of it And then he invites others to at least live off the faith and hope he has. And that's just a beautiful picture of how the church should be with the Lord's Supper. That this is not only our hope in the midst of the storm. This is the hope of the world. And we want you to know that, and we want to remain centered on that. I think one of the most simple ways I could explain this particular point is, when we're going through the deepest, darkest, most difficult storms, that is not the place to abandon communion and faith and the church and the Lord's Supper and the Eucharist. That's the worst time, because that's what it's made for. It's made to be food for the storm, not just a convenient pick-me-up when life's going well. It's made to be in the midst of the darkest, most difficult scene. God is there for us, because that Eucharist always represents before us the cross and resurrection. That it in and of itself speaks of how in the midst of the hopelessness and despair of the cross, that we eat of food that is the risen life of Christ. He gave His flesh, He gave His blood, but we are not just eating these things, we are instead partaking in the flesh and blood of Christ, which is risen and alive and is the promise and our hope for the future. So we have a storm, we have a Eucharist, which is food for the storm, and then we have a man which reminds us of the kind of faith that we need to carry in the midst of these storms. If you're my age or older, you may remember a TV series, Charles in Charge. Yeah, that's where this comes. That's, instead of Charles in Charge, Paul's in charge. And what's strange is we start the story with him absolutely not in control. I dare say most, if not all of us, would collapse after being a prisoner for years in chains, having to defend ourselves against accusations which were not true. And as we got on that ship to Rome, it'd be very hard for us to be anything but a blubbering mess and just in complete despair that, oh my gosh, here goes. But Paul, without being in control, having no sense of ownership of anything, he is absolutely a captive, rises above, because even though he's in chains, he's free. He's free in Christ. And so he begins to care. He cares enough to give expert advice about weather and navigation when perhaps no one wants it. He cares enough to carry himself with amazing calm in the middle of a raging storm. He helps to head off the mutiny when the people want to let off the lifeboat. He is in the midst of the people who are completely losing hope and saying, guys, take courage. Take courage. We will survive this. Paul, who has so little control, ends up being the one who is in absolute charge. And the reason he is because he's placed himself completely at the mercy of Christ. Why do I say that? There's one other story in our Bible that has this long, extended, detailed shipwreck. Does it come to mind? There's the story of Jonah. Jonah is told, go and preach to the Gentiles. Preach to them that God will grant them repentance if they'll repent. And Jonah says, I'm not going. And instead heads off in the entire opposite direction, gets on a ship. And then we see this same kind of pattern play out for Jonah. And Jonah is doing everything in his power not to do what God wants. He ends up being tossed overboard. He's placed in the belly of the fish. He's puked up on the land. And then he reluctantly goes and preaches. And then complains when they repent. You know the story, right? This is the opposite of Jonah. Because it's the same mission. Go to the ends of the earth. Go preach to the Gentiles. And Paul, instead of doing all that Jonah does, has placed himself at the mercy of Christ and put himself in the most dangerous position possible, because he's willing to do whatever is necessary to get the gospel to Rome. It is almost so much a 180 of Jonah, you almost feel bad calling it a 180, because it's like a 180 plus, 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 plus. He just is showing us the way that a prophet of God ought to go in longing to get the message out to all people. So Paul is in charge, and he's in charge not because he's got all the authority. He's in charge because he's placed himself at the mercy of the one with all authority, and who ends up truly being in control even in the midst of this difficult storm. Well, I want to close with this. When I was looking up pictures for this, I came across all these inspiring pictures, and I just want to show you three, because they really highlight the power of just trusting God. One of these, you know, has that ship in the storm courage. And you have Paul's statements, I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I've been told. I pray to God, I wish to God, I hope to God that that would be how I approach every promise of God. That I believe what you've said is true. And that's the reason Paul has courage. Or I love this, keep up your courage, not one of you will be lost. And then finally, I just love the fact that because of the courage, because of the faith, all were brought safely to land. The winds are against us. They always will be. We should actually be a little bit suspicious if we are right in line with our world's current. If we don't have any resistance, we're just floating with the stream. We ought to just be thinking, what's wrong with us? Because truly, if we're walking in the way of Christ, we are going to be going against the stream. And the winds will be against us. And the storms will arise. But there is the faith to ride that storm out if we stand on the promise of God and we remain true no matter what we encounter. Would you pray with me?